Good day. All sites are now online in the listen-only mode. Later, there will be an opportunity to ask questions. At that time, you can enter the question-and-answer queue by pressing star one. It's now my pleasure to hand off the conference to your moderator, Dan Beaton. Please go ahead, sir.
Sure. Greetings, everyone. Thank you for participating in today's call, which is organized by Jubilee USA. I'm Dan Beaton, International Communications Coordinator for the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and I'll be moderating the call today. This call will examine Ecuador's foreign debt, and in particular, the results of a recent debt audit and the decision facing Ecuador's government on whether it will default on its debt. We're going to hear from two experts on this topic, Neil Watkins, Executive Director of Jubilee USA, and Mark Weisbrot, Co-Director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Ecuador will announce a decision on Monday regarding debt payment on approximately $3.8 billion in foreign debt. This comes after a 30-day grace period in which debt payments were suspended based on serious irregularities in the country's debt history, as detailed in a 172-page final report by an independent public credit audit commission. If Ecuador defaults, it will be the first Latin American country to do so since Argentina in 2001. In that case, Argentina defaulted on its external debt in the midst of an economic crisis following years of recession, and the default arguably allowed the government to implement new macroeconomic policies and begin the road to economic recovery. There's no doubt that Ecuador's audit of its foreign debt is a precedent-setting move and could have implications far beyond Ecuador. So first we're going to hear from Neil, and then we'll be joined by Mark. Each speaker will make a brief presentation, and then we'll have time for Q&A. So, Neil, please go ahead.
Thank you, Dan. My name is Neil Watkins, and I'm the Executive Director of Jubilee USA Network. We're an alliance of 75 religious denominations, faith-based groups, development agencies, and human rights groups based here in the United States working to build the political will for debt relief and for more responsible lending and borrowing policies. We're also the U.S. arm of a global Jubilee campaign, which has branches in more than 60 countries around the world. I'll just be very brief today and share first a bit about the situation in Ecuador today. Ecuador today has a debt of $14 billion. The origins of this debt date back to the late 1970s, when a dictatorial regime in the country contracted a $3.4 billion debt, which has, with further borrowing, ballooned to today's levels. Debt service is exacting a large social cost in Ecuador as the financial crisis sets in the country. In 2007, Ecuador paid $1.75 billion in debt service, more than the government spent on healthcare, social well-being, housing and urban development, and the environment combined. As part of its commitments to help the poor and the environment, the government has committed to significantly increase social spending by 2010. Without finding a way to reduce debt service payments, it will be very difficult for Ecuador to meet these commitments to its people. Amidst this backdrop, the Ecuadorian government, under significant pressure from Jubilee Ecuador and other civil society groups with whom we work, convened a commission of independent experts to undertake an audit of the country's debts. That commission released a report in September of this year, which detailed numerous cases of illegality, illegitimacy, and onerousness in the contraction of Ecuador's debt. Based on those findings, in late November, the Ecuadorian president highlighted a particular debt, the global bonds, as having significant irregularities surrounding its negotiation and suspended payment of interest on the bonds. In the bond contract, Ecuador is allowed a 30-day grace period before it goes into default. So why has Ecuador taken this action? First, the government acted in part in response to civil society calls from the Global Jubilee Movement to examine so-called odious and illegitimate debts. These are debts contracted by prior regimes which did not provide social benefit. The Audit Commission's report alleges that the way the bonds were contracted violated the Ecuadorian Constitution, other national laws, as well as several general principles of international law. Second, the payment of debt service in Ecuador is exacting a human toll. Each dollar paid in debt service on dubious debts is one less dollar to fight poverty, which is growing as a result of the current crisis. It is important to note that the government of Ecuador has not yet made a decision to formally default on this bond or any other debt. We work almost exclusively with Ecuadorian civil society and don't have any knowledge or particular insights about what particular course of action the Ecuadorian government will eventually take on November 15th when the grace period on these particular bonds expires. But we do recognize that the Ecuadorian government, like so many other developing country governments, faces an impossible choice: default and risk losing access to credit, or continue to pay an illegitimate debt at tremendous social cost. The fact that governments like Ecuador are forced into a corner like this belies a more fundamental problem: the lack of an independent body to which sovereign debtors can present claims of illegitimacy or insolvency. Until this structural deficiency is changed, cycles of reckless lending and borrowing are sure to continue. We hope the current crisis in the case of Ecuador renews the global policy debate about the need for new global rules and a new global framework for responsible lending, which allows countries to submit disputes about debt claims to an independent body and work out comprehensive and orderly solutions to debt problems that treat debtors and creditors fairly. Thank you very much.
Okay, and next we'll have Mark Weisbrock, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Go ahead, Mark.
Thanks. Thanks, Neil, and thanks for everybody for coming. I just wanted to make a few points about the economics of the situation that are sometimes overlooked. The question, of course, is what would be the consequences of defaulting on bonds like this? And they're often portrayed as very dire, but in reality, it really depends on the situation of the country. Argentina is a good example of a country that defaulted on its debt in 2002, and immediately, after one quarter, actually, despite the fact that everyone predicted that this default would lead to a long period of stagnation because of the denial of access to credit markets. They grew continuously, and they're actually still growing now, although the economy is just starting to slow. They grew continuously, had a record economic expansion of about 60%, pulling 12 million people across the poverty line, very successful. So in their case, which is different than Ecuador's, but nonetheless, the default was seen as a potential disaster. It turned out to be an extremely important move. It's really difficult to even argue, for anyone to argue, that they could have had this kind of recovery if they had continued to pay the debt service burden that they had overall. So it can, in fact, be a very important move in certain situations, and Argentina is definitely one of them. In fact, if you look at Argentina's situation now, it seems the main mistake they made was not defaulting enough, in the sense that they thought that they, by reaching an agreement with the vast majority of creditors, they would be able to access international markets, and in fact they didn't. So that agreement turned out to be worth a lot less than, because of the holdout bondholders, that agreement turned out to be worth a lot less than they thought it was worth, in the sense that they're paying off quite a bit of this debt, about a third of it, and not getting anything for it because of the holdout bondholders. A couple of other things I would add on the economics of it. The purpose of borrowing, the idea that a developing country should borrow from abroad, the purpose of this idea is that, in the textbook economics, is that they are able to borrow and use the resources that they borrow and invest them for a return that is higher than what they end up paying back to the creditors. And if they can't do that, or if they don't get it, or if because of a long period of corrupt governments or other circumstances, they can't actually do that, that is, that they don't actually benefit from the foreign borrowing, then it doesn't really make sense to go for a long period of time simply paying off debt for the purpose of paying off debt. So it very often doesn't make economic sense when a country is stuck in a situation where there's no foreseeable change. In other words, and there are a lot of countries in the world in this situation where they're going to, as far as you can see into the future, they're going to keep on paying off debt, but they're never going to, at least as far as you can see, reach a situation where the country actually benefits from the foreign capital. That is, gets a return from it that's higher than what they can, what they have to pay off. So it can be a rational economic decision. And the consequences are not always as great as one might think. Argentina is just one example. But in the Ecuadorian case, for example, right now they can't really borrow on international markets anyway. So they're in a strong bargaining position to renegotiate this debt with their creditors. Okay, I'll stop there. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mark. Operator, if you could please let the journalists on the call know how they can get in the queue to ask a question, then we can go ahead with questions.
Certainly, sir. At this time, ladies and gentlemen, if you do have an audio question, simply press the star, then one on your touchtone phone. You may withdraw your question at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, star one to ask an audio question. And again, simply press the star, then one to ask a question. And our first question comes to us from Walter Brandemark from Reuters. Go ahead, please.
Hi, New. Hi, Mark. How are you?
Hello.
I have two questions, actually. The first one would be, what do you see the Ecuadorian authorities trying to accomplish by visiting all those countries in Latin America and also here in the U.S.? Do you believe they can get their support somehow for a tough decision to default on their debt? This would be one question. The other one is the decision by Ecuador not to pay its debt going to be based, in your view, more on the ability to pay because maybe oil prices are falling now and they're going to have problems next year, or this is more because of the legality of the debt?
Mark, do you want to take that?
Well, sure, I could take some of it, and you can add something if you want. I think they are hoping to get support, and I think they will, certainly in South America. They'll get support, and they may get support. Neil will be able to say more about that here from the from sectors in the United States who have been very much attuned to the movement that Neil is representing here, a long-term movement for debt relief, which I have to underscore that this is where this comes from. It isn't just from the government of Ecuador by any means. So I think they will get support. Even, like I said, from governments in South America and also from some sectors in the United States that care about social justice issues. On the other, what was the other part of the question?
The other part is whether this this decision will be based more on the ability to pay because maybe oil prices are falling too much and Ecuador might have a problem next year, or on this legality discussion? Because most of the times I see those discussions a little mixed up, and I don't quite understand. Sometimes the argument is that the debt is not legal. Sometimes it's because, well, maybe oil prices are too low, and so Ecuador is not going to have enough money to, at the same time, service its debt and invest in social policies. So I think this is a little. Which of the two arguments is the most important, in your opinion?
Well, I think they're both important, and they are related. I mean, when faced with debt that's of questionable legitimacy at a time when they would have to cut social spending or go back on some of their promises in order to continue to pay this debt, and I think. They would rather default on the debt, possibly. And so I think they are related. I think they are making both arguments. And I should say I think it is related to the crisis because the international economic crisis right now is very uncertain. We don't really know when the recovery would be. We don't know what oil prices are going to do. My own opinion is that they're overshot quite a bit in the direction, in the other direction. That is, they'll probably go up. But we don't really know. I mean, it could be, you know, there's no sign of recovery here in the United States, for example. Everything is still getting worse. We don't know how effective the fiscal policies of the rich countries, which are, you know, still the majority of the world economy, whether they're going to help, whether they're going to be enough, and whether they're going to be soon enough. And so I think this is why this is, ends up being having implications beyond Ecuador. One reason is that in this the crisis was clearly originated here in the United States and to a lesser extent in other rich countries. And here you have the developing countries being asked to bear the burden of it. And some of them are being helped, too. Like, you know, I think Ecuador would be a different situation, for example, if the Federal Reserve created a $30 billion swap arrangement like it did for Brazil and Mexico and South Korea and Singapore.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not doing that. So governments are going to have to make choices. If this recession deepens, governments that are not being helped by the centers of the world economy that created the mess, are going to be asking, well, why should we be the ones, and why should we ask our citizens, who clearly are in favor of default, I mean, by a 60%, you know, 60-40 margin in Ecuador, why should we force them to pay the, you know, to bear the burdens of a crisis that was created elsewhere, and now we're suffering for it? So I think that's a very important part of what you're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, just to add to that, this is Neil, I think... I mean, I would agree the decision, both factors are going to play into it. Obviously, the financial crisis and the challenges of paying debt in Ecuador. But I actually think primary in this case is the allegations of illegality and irregularities in the specific debt, and that really what spurred the government to take such a close examination of this debt and now to begin discussing, you know, the options it will have. Was the strong call from civil society a promise during the campaign by the government to commission a group of experts to audit the debt, and then the year-plus process of auditing? So I think, though the financial crisis is playing in, that actually the very serious claims of irregularities in the debt will be is sort of the primary issue. And I think in terms of the support Ecuador may or may not get, but I can't really comment on Latin America, but in the United States, certainly there is a constituency which we represent of religious communities, of human rights groups, of development organizations that have long highlighted the impacts of the third world debt crisis more than 30 years ago, and continue to highlight that. So certainly the Ecuadorian government will will be understood by those communities and will be communicating that our understanding to political decision makers who have been supportive of debt relief and some of the difficult and understand the difficult choices that developing countries like Ecuador have to make.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. I'd like to ask one more question, but maybe I can go back later if someone else has another one. I don't know.
I think we have another question in our queue right now, so maybe if you don't mind, Walter.
Yeah, no, not at all. Yeah.
So, okay, operator, let's take the next question, please.
Yes, sir. Our next question comes to us from Naomi Mapson from the Financial Times. Go ahead, please. Your line is open.
Hi. I've got two questions also. The first one being about what body Ecuador could appeal to at the moment. You say that there's a lack of any kind of appropriate system that can arbitrate this international conflict. So I'm interested to know what should be done in your view, and if there is any actual body that applies in the interval. And secondly, the question about whether Ecuador can actually pay its debt at the moment. A lot of analysts say that Ecuador is currently in a position to pay, even though it's heading into a very difficult period. But I'd like to know your thoughts on what exactly is constraining Ecuador's ability to pay. Specifically, is dollarization an issue, and the fact that they effectively don't have monetary policy instruments? Anyway, like your thoughts on that.
Sure. Well, maybe I can take a stab at that first. I think in terms of the bodies that Ecuador can appeal to, the bonds in question are they are governed by New York law. So the first place or the, you know, sort of the actual place that this conversation will begin to happen, depending on what the government does, is in probably a New York courtroom. The problem with that, of course, is that there are a lot of the irregularities are things that have been identified as inconsistent with Ecuadorian law and international law. But it's unclear, and I think there are lawyers now looking at whether it may indeed violate U.S. law. But it's unclear whether that will be. We would certainly argue that's not a sufficient venue. Some of the other options then would be, for example, at the United Nations level, the International Court of Justice is an option, though there is not a lot of precedent. I think that may be something that the Ecuadorian government might consider bringing this to, because it is a place that is at least in consideration of international legal principles. But overall, I mean, there are those are both very imperfect options for the sort of situation we're in. And, you know, there have been discussions over the years about creating such a framework that could govern debt disputes in an impartial way, because one of the problems now is even if you go to a New York court, you know, this is not going to be worked out in an orderly, efficient way that benefits either Ecuador. I mean, it'll take 2 or 4 years for this process to go through. And it also won't be necessarily fair to bondholders because, you know, those bondholders that are able to be most efficient and act may get a better deal than others, and there will be others that will hold out and hold out the process. So there needs – it points to what we think is the need for a more of an independent international mechanism for debt workouts, and not only in the cases of inability to pay, but also in this case, which I think is more a case of irregularity of the debt rather than an inability to pay. And I'll let Mark add to that, but I think, from our point of view, the inability to pay is less a technical economic point than an inability to invest sufficiently in fighting poverty and in social services, and it's clear that Ecuador is facing a challenge there, and that challenge will grow, and that the challenge Ecuador will face if it continues to pay this level of debt service will be a challenge in not being able to fight poverty and meet the needs of its people.
Excuse me just a second. Operator, there seems to be a bit of interference on the line. I don't know if everyone's hearing that.
Yes, sir. It's apparently coming from the Financial Times line.
Okay. I'm sorry, Naomi. Would it be possible if we mute you just temporarily while we get answers?
Sure.
Okay. Maybe we can unmute you if you have follow-up questions or something.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Okay, Mark, did you have something to add to that as well?
Just on the question of ability to pay, I mean, clearly the Ecuador is not in the situation that Argentina was in at the end of 2001, where it was, you know, they just couldn't pay that debt at all. It was almost impossible. Although even then, I mean, ability to pay is always a question of, it's always possible in the sense, I mean, you know, the creditors wanted to restructure it in a way that it could eventually be paid off and it would pose an unbearable burden on the economy and the budget and the people, and that wasn't acceptable. And so here, obviously, the debt is nowhere near that size, but you have a situation where because the people of the country see this, and this debt is illegitimate, they see it as debt that was contracted under governments in which they had no say. And so this is part, I mean, I know that, you know, it's not looked at this way by creditors, but there is a question of democracy here as well. I mean, the people of the country voted for a government partly because of this. They wanted them to deal with the debt in a different manner, and they see it as they don't want to make the sacrifices, and it could be very serious sacrifices depending on what happens to the economy over the next year or two. In order to pay this debt, which was borrowed, much of it was borrowed by a dictatorship. It was restructured by governments that they considered to be corrupt and that they didn't have a say in it, and they didn't benefit from the proceeds of the debt, of the borrowing. That is, it didn't end up being invested in the productive capacity of the country. So I think that's what, when we're talking about ability to pay, it's always like that. There's always some way that a country could pay off a debt if they wanted to. And in this case, there is. But it's a question of sacrifice relative to what people are willing to accept.
Okay. I think we have a couple more questions. Can we take the next question, operator?
Certainly. We'll now go to Tim Pedger from Time Magazine. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I'm just curious. This is more sort of a general question, but just in a regional sense. There's been so much talk in recent years of you know, governments in Latin America, particularly South America, trying to find more regional-based solutions to these kinds of problems. Has there been any input from you know, groups like UNASUR or just Brazil and Venezuela, you know, countries that are sort of aspiring to more leadership in the region, at, you know, as to how to handle these kinds of situations, these debt situations?
Mark, maybe you want to take that.
Yeah, well, there was that ALBA meeting just recently where all the countries that were there, which included Ecuador, Venezuela, Bolivia, Nicaragua, Honduras, Dominica, they all said that they supported Ecuador's decision and that they themselves would look into forming debt commissions, debt audit commissions.
And, but did they offer any kind of specific or concrete recommendations or suggestions?
Not in terms of, you know, what, you know, setting up a new organization to resolve these problems or anything like that.
Has UNASUR weighed in at all?
No.
On this kind of thing? Okay.
No, and I wouldn't expect them to either. I mean, the thing is on the debt issues, I mean, all these countries are in very different situations.
Yeah.
And so it would be hard to forge a consensus on that.
Okay. Thanks.
Did you want to add anything to that, Neil?
No, I think that's great.
Okay. Can we have the next question, please?
Certainly. Our next question comes to us from Elvira Palomo from ESC News. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, good morning. I'd like to know what do you recommend Ecuador to do in this situation? Should they have to pay or should they go wait until the lawyer's resolution, or what do you recommend?
I don't have a recommendation, actually. I can't really say. I think it's really got to be a decision for their government.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly wouldn't, as Jubilee, tell a sovereign government what to do, but I think what I would say is that because the Jubilee campaign has long worked for these audits, that is, asked governments to form commissions to examine, you know, the nature of a lot of this debt, to look at some of the origins of it, that we have supported that audit process. We've supported Ecuadorian civil society for a long time in building to the creation of that commission. And so we hope the government, you know, takes seriously the allegations that the audit commission finds, and whether they decide to, you know, bring that in the form of a legal case, whether they decide to publicize it, whether they decide to take more drastic action, you know, we think that that's the important thing, is that the findings of that commission get publicized and that action is taken in some way to address it. And I think Ecuador can help serve as a model for other developing countries in terms of forming commissions like this, and can start the conversation about the inadequacy right now of the global financial architecture to deal with claims either of illegality or illegitimacy, and to deal with cases of inability to pay. And I don't necessarily think that Ecuador, in the strict economic sense, meets that criteria. But there are many other countries that do. And in the global economy right now, there is no equivalent of bankruptcy. There is no impartial, independent of the creditors way that countries can contest debt claims.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, let's have our next question.
And just a reminder to our participants, if you do have an audio question, press the star, then one. We'll now go back to Walter Brandomarte from Reuters.
Hi. Mark, my question would be, you've been comparing the Ecuadorian case with the Argentine case, and you argue that Argentina was really successful with its restructuring of the debt because the country grew. So from an economic point of view, would you recommend Ecuador to suspend payment from this economic point of view? Would you recommend Ecuador to suspend payment on its debt? And then, if Ecuador is successful, which other countries you believe should follow in Latin America?
Well, I can't make that kind of a recommendation because it really depends. You know, there are costs to default.
Exactly.
In the case of Ecuador, I don't think, you know, the cost would be huge because, like I said, they're already in a situation where they can't borrow internationally anyway, mm-hmm. and it would be some time before they could. So you wouldn't necessarily, if they defaulted, for example, just like they're talking about on the global 2012 bonds, it's hard to see how their credit situation would be drastically different than it is right now.
Mm-hmm.
It would be different, but I mean, the difference could end up being marginal.
Okay, and if they are successful, which countries do you think would be in a position to follow and try to look at their debt as well, see if there are illegalities or?
I think Neil may be better positioned to answer that one because he's looked at the debt situations of other countries.
Yeah, I mean, just in terms of countries to follow suit, the Jubilee campaigns in Latin America are all pressuring all the governments to establish these commissions. Now, that's the first step. It's really an analysis step. So it would depend on what the findings are of those respective commissions. I understand there are a number of governments that are considering establishing debt audit commissions, which is, I think, a positive development, because if we're going to, in essence, stop the pattern of reckless lending, of lending with insufficient oversight, of borrowing that is done without, proper processes and procedures at a national level, we've got to know what happened in the past to learn lessons for the future. So I think the first step is to encourage other governments to undertake these commissions, see what the results are, and then take it on a case-by-case basis. You can't, call before you know the information for further action. But I think it's important to learn from the past to learn the lessons for the future.
Okay,
are there any further questions?
And just a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, if you do have an audio question, press the star, then one. Here's we have a question from Joshua Partlow from The Washington Post. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I was just curious if you could tell me if the issue with Ecuador not paying back the BNDES debt to Brazil, is that part of this issue and what's going to be decided on Monday, or is it a separate debt?
I don't know. I think that question probably better directed to the embassy or the Ecuadorian government in terms of its exact status. I do know that that particular claim was one of the issues that President Correa raised when he also raised this global bond issue in Quito on November 20th. So,
okay.
I think it is, there were a lot of findings in this audit commission, and I think it's notable to point out that the government is highlighting one or two, a few of the most egregious examples in terms of what they see as debts with irregularities and potential illegitimacies, and the global bonds and that BNDES loans seem to be the two of the main examples they're highlighting. But I don't know what will happen on that.
Can I say something on that?
Yeah.
Just as a political matter, I would find it very unlikely that the government would default to the BNDES. I think that I think it's pretty unlikely. I think that they would. It would just be, first of all, it would be very relatively much easier for Ecuador and Brazil to work out their differences than it would be with, you know, say, all the holders of the global bonds. So I don't expect trouble there. I know that, you know, I was just in Brazil, and the media there is making a big thing out of it. And they tend to do that there whenever there's trouble between Brazil and the neighboring government, you know, whether it's Bolivia or Ecuador. But I think it's been exaggerated. I don't expect it that there would be it end up being a default there or anything close to it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And just to follow up, is it possible to explain just an example or two about what these irregularities or illegalities are, and besides the fact that it was the borrowing took place under a dictatorship?
Yeah, well, they're in the report. They document, looks like, about 8 specific issues with the global 2012 bonds that were either illegal under the Ecuadorian constitution, Ecuadorian national law, and or violated general principles of international law. I mean, I think one of the most notable is the fact that the way the actual authority within the Ecuadorian government to sign off on the agreement in the latest time that they restructured their bonds in 2000, that the agency which had that authority or that signed did not have authority under the Constitution to sign on behalf of Ecuador. So that's one point they're making. Another allegation they make is that the issuers of the global bonds might have violated rules in terms of registering public offerings with the SEC. And then they, you know, they have a sort of a very detailed legalistic list, which we'd be happy to share. I'm not myself a lawyer, but it's in the. I mean, the report, this executive summary, has been released publicly, so you can see sort of what specifically their claims are.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Do we have any further questions in the queue?
Yes, sir. It appears we have a follow-up from the Financial Times site. Naomi Netmaps.
Oh, hi, Mark. I just wanted to ask you specifically about the way the Ecuadorian economy is being managed, whether you think that Correa is hamstrung by the fact that the economy is dollarized, and does that add to his problems in trying to
Sound is a little tough here. He's hamstrung by what?
Dollarization.
Oh, a dollarization. In this economic situation?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, it is a handicap, yeah, because you don't have control over monetary or exchange rate policy, basically, mm-hmm. if you're using another country's currency. And those are two important tools to deal with a crisis, and it hurts. Particularly right now, the dollar has risen 20% in the last few months, and so that that's a blow to them as well, and they can't do anything about it. You know, other countries have been letting their currencies fall. I mean, Brazilian currency is falling, you know, from 1.6 to 2.5 to the dollar. And the, for example, so, yeah, that is a problem. It's, you know, it's something that Correa talked about even when he was running for president, and he didn't like it, but he felt, and I think correctly, that the last couple of years were not the time to change that.
Thank you.
Sure.
And I'm showing no further questions at this time. Do you have any closing comments, sir?
Yes. I just want to let the journalists know that we will have a MP3 recording of this available. And if you need any follow-up information or to get a copy of that recording, you can email me at beaton@ceper.net, and that is B as in boy, EETON@ceper.net. Thanks, everybody, very much for participating in our call today. Hopefully it was useful for you.
And on behalf of Jubilee USA, thank you as well for joining us.
Yes, thank you very much.